Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. This is Kevin Boileau, one of your hosts at Epos Radio. It is April 24th, 2020, the year 2020. And we have a specially scheduled interview today on the topic of deep listening with Dr. Larae Dawes. Dr. Dawes is a prominent psychologist, psychotherapist, and has grown a career as well as a psychoanalyst in North America. He's located in Canada. His background is too extensive to mention beyond that. Suffice it to say, he knows what he's talking about. And I thought it would be a whole lot of fun to have Dr. Dawes on the radio here at Epos Radio to add to the discussion about listening, and especially deep listening. You know, we've been at this topic for a few weeks now and trying to develop a conversation about it. We think about the world at large. We think about ecosystems, earth science, the morality of the treatment of those who are weaker, disabled, the elderly, the young, non-human animals, water, air. So we think about how everything comes together as an integrated whole. In existentialism, we call that worlding. You know, how do we create a world? What is our noetic impetus and noetic focus when we do that? And some people say that we have a listening problem, that we're so focused on the domination of the gaze, especially in science. The medical gaze can be a very domineering, colonizing sort of gaze. The gaze of government, the gaze of bureaucracy, the gaze of a psychotherapist, gaze of a friend, parent, spouse, lover. We are saturated with media, and we're saturated with imagery, the imagination, the imaginary, and I think it's highly arguable that we're so focused on what we see as motivation to living in the life world that we miss out on hearing or listening to the life world itself. We miss out on listening to other life forms. We miss out on listening to people most important in our lives. We've talked about the difference between calculative thinking of the medical gaze, instrumental thinking of the consumer gaze, and how that's very different from a meditative, contemplative sort of a thinking. I, for one, am concerned that we're not listening like we should. And there may be consequences of that. I think it's also highly arguable from my experiences that people who need clinical, medical, or psychotherapeutic help are also not really being listened to, or they're being listened to only theoretically or instrumentally. So suffice it to say, listening can be a problem. And I wanted then to bring Dr. Dawes, Dr. Larae, out to the show here and welcome him. Dr. Dawes, are you on the show?
Good morning, Kevin. Thank you for that introduction. It was beautiful.
You're welcome. Thank you for joining us today, Larae. So I want to ask you, I'm going to start from the very general and see if we can explore various topics that are important to you within this general question. But let's start with a working definition. What is deep listening? What is that all about, both as a human being and clinically? How can you help us frame an answer to that question?
I had a few associations with your introduction, which again, I think was so well-crafted. And I'm surprised how many of the thoughts as I was preparing is overlapped. But if I think of deep listening, and when you asked me to talk about it, the first thing that came up for me was memories for me of where I felt listened to, where I felt that something of myself was understood by someone else. I could add, and I think many times when we think about this, we think of that the experience per definition was only good. There was no shame or embarrassment or difficulty. But I think we limit ourselves with binary thinking like good or bad. It was an experience, a deep experience of having someone as a background presence that I did not experience, as you said, that gaze, or that gaze wanted to structure me in any specific way. The first thing that came to mind, I remember Eigen said, Michael Eigen, when he spoke to Beyond, and Beyond said to him he needs to get married. Beyond said that marriage is speaking truth to each other. It's a relationship to help mitigate the severity of yourself. And I think, I'm not sure, I think it's Immanuel Kant that said that he felt understood and listened to only once in his life, but that was more than enough. So true listening, or as I experienced it in my own analysis, was that I felt a presence rather than being hollowed out, and I could hear myself differently. It's a unique echo chamber where I could pick myself up, parts of myself up, and move forward. It even provides a sense of peace and rest and joy in a completely different way than, for example, pedagogical learning, or acquiring something, or to use your language, to better our possessive self, which it will reassert itself eventually. Later, if we have time, I think Bertrand Russell also put it beautifully. His mathematical self, and him as a philosopher and scientist, and having a spiritual experience. So a deep listening to me is truly a way of being with each other, where one can experience oneself in a different way. And I think it's a true art that belongs to the auditory. Again, your introduction talked about the gaze, and the gaze is calculative. As I was thinking of your work, is how to move from a calculative gaze to meditative ears. I think ears can suffer. Listening can suffer commodification as well, that we listen for specific things and we focus on specific things, which is also true in psychotherapy, listening for irrational thoughts or certain structures of pathology, which I think forecloses the bridge between two people if they together in a existential hermeneutical being togetherness. So it's also not a performance or having to master a skill, which by definition could also be important. It's an ability to be present with oneself and another as a background simultaneously. And it is, unfortunately, I fear a dying art. And I know I focus just between two people, which I think is my limitation. I think your work and any other work extends that to our gaze and our hearing of nature, how we treat animals, and many other areas as well. But I do believe cultivating a deep listening can maybe help us free and reuse our psychoanalytic ears, which takes quite a bit of practice. And well, maybe I should speak to of myself. It took me quite a while to start trusting what I hear and not just what I see. We tend to be quite a visual culture. Unfortunately, it makes us all Houdinis. The eyes can be tricked very quickly. The ears, I think, may be more sensitive to truth than our eyes. It's maybe one of the reasons where many of our most gifted theorists, like Wilfred Bion, Sigmund Freud, Michael Eigen, are all into blinding ourselves artificially so that we could lean in and hear what is being communicated to us. So that would be, a very basic approach for me to listening.
Yeah, I have some thoughts on that. So I remember years ago I was a teenager studying Frohm, believe it or not, and we had an exercise where half the class would be blinded for the whole day. And the other half of the class would be our shepherds and guides and try to get us through the day without getting in trouble. And I remember not being able to see for 8 hours. And after a while, it did change the way I heard things. I want to jump into a technical question that you and I have been delving into for quite some time, and that's the issue of transcendence or transcendent structure, transcendent self-structure, the faculty of transcendence. And it seems to me that if you have a worldview that postulates that the very self manifests interrelationally, in other words, myself emerges or presences from structure and from a position or a place in an interrelational matrix. In other words, I come to being in the midst of others. And it seems to me, if that's true, that the way that the other's gaze upon initially a child would determine how much transcendental structure or potential for transcendental structure that child may have. So another way to talk about it is that, I'll put it as a question to you. So if we'll just talk about two people. So if the gaze of the other towards you as a certain kind of gaze, do you think that that loving gaze, the listening gaze, can actually open up an internal transcendental structure in the recipient of the gaze such that the recipient of the gaze is afforded a greater ability to listen to herself and to others based upon that interrelational dynamic, say, as opposed to being gazed at in a colonizing way, domination way, authoritarian way, where there's no transcendental structure created in the recipient. Do you have some thoughts on?
Yes, I do. I think you just articulated the deep hope of the analytic situation. I think if I read Freud, people like Michael Eigen's work on the sensitive self, on the challenge of being human, emotional storm, most of those volumes speak to an ongoing, commitment to the Freudian idiom of free association that had a deep dream for man, a vision for man, that if we could engage in a certain kind of dialogue, in a certain way of being together, it could open up possibilities of getting in touch with oneself in terms of, if I think of the old design analyst, in terms of Eigenwelt, Mittwelt, Umwelt, and Überwelt, that these areas, these natural ways of being, will become open to one and another in such a way that deepening, thickening of narrative and expression of self intrapsychically, interpersonally can deepen with a hope of moreness. Your thinking is also reminding me, it's a philosophical description of Winnicottian play, a capacity between the self and the other to create a transitional space where creative play of self can come about, can be refound, reclaimed, and elaborated. It's also true, I think, out of your positioning when you talked about the gays as being colonizing, that much of what happens in analysis, as my one supervisor, Professor DeVos, would usually say, psychoanalysis, a soul releasement, spends a lot of its time trying to language the gaze, to find a bridge over the gaze, so that this process of the transcendental structures, which is inherent in man, kind of an epistemophilic drive in man, can be reasserted. But it comes up against tremendous cultural forces, tremendous. Most analytic theorists move to themes like Moses and monotheism. Even the great Robert Langs gave examples, seeing a person coming up against an army of expectations. I sometimes think, many times people ask me, do we humans have a problem of listening? And my natural, unreflective answer would be yes. We just have to look at group relationships, interpersonal conflict, even when people come to therapy, how they were misunderstood, categorized, and in a way not allowed to listen to themselves or really see themselves as they would like to see themselves. That they have to listen and see themselves through another. Christopher Bolas sometimes say, if he listens to an analyst who is speaking now, it's not necessarily the client. So something that you bring up for us for thinking is, and this is very Sullivanian in a sense, is how were we taught to listen? And how were we allowed to hear? Meaning, I think our gaze and our ears have maybe not differentiated in such a way to remain in contact with the true self, or in your language, the transcendental structures that is willing to play, partake in creative acts that many times psychoanalysis or psychotherapy or a deep friendship, a soul friendship, anamkara, is maybe the only time where someone can allow us, through beautiful questions, as Michael White would say it, to start developing the equipment to hear. I think these specialized conversations that philosophers have, or psychoanalysts, or other colleagues from other fields, I think Derrida and Habermas and all of these individuals were master in creating dialogues to allow people to get in touch with themselves, is that being a visual-based culture makes it difficult Many times we say to people, I hear you, but I think we say, I see you. You know, and this gets given to children. We want to be seen. So it creates something different in our way of being in the world than someone, again, artificially blinding themselves. Even sometimes if we see how psychoanalysts sit in the room, so to allow you to talk and not be under the gaze constantly, so that this transcendental structure might get an opportunity to rebuild itself, if at all possible. I'm sure we'll get into it. I think many of our theories, like Hedges, James Masterson, and many others, have given us microscopic ways of languaging and listening that we might have to structure ourselves a bit differently in time for the native self, for the autochthonous drive to feel that it have faith again, to bridge itself to alterity, a world that they found is extremely difficult, overwhelming, overstimulating, or just plain dangerous, meaning there's a lack of trust. And that takes quite a while to build up again. But it is possible, and the transcendental is possible. It's inherent in us.
Yeah, it's been my experience in group psychotherapy that, and even more so as we move into the complete and utter present, that we have been so conditioned and so evolution selects so much for instrumental reasoning, calculative reasoning. We're rewarded by thinking in ways that support a particular role we play, like parent, spouse, worker, kind of a matrix. We're so rewarded to think on the surface in many ways. That's how we get more work done. We make more money. We accomplish more at home. Those sorts of things. And so if you have a social structure that is almost completely, or say predominantly, structured to reward calculative, instrumental reasoning, in which values are based on use, utility, and not an extrinsic goals like money, like professional accolades, like getting children to do well in school, items like that. So if we have that social structure, and we can see it in group, because the group is a microcosm. And if we can see it in group where people are so defended against deep listening because it hurts, or deep listening because it makes us too vulnerable, or deep listening because it's not so rewarded, then the question I have for you is, how do we tease out, or how do we help people transform, not only individually, relationally, familially, socially, to develop, inculcate and develop a capacity for a deep listening? And I say this now, given the current status that we're in the world with the COVID-19 pandemic, it seems to me that there's a lot more anxiety. I'm sensing more anxiety. Mm-hmm. I'm sensing people, more people in their fight or flight brain, their reptilian brain, less capable of contemplative, rational, meditative thinking. How do we reel this back, and do we want to? Do we want to help ourselves become more available to meditative thinking and to deep listening? So it's a two-part question. Do we want it, and why? And how do we do it? Dr. Das, how do we how do we help each other get to that state where we can listen better?
That's quite the question. My first association was many times when people come for a specialized conversation or for therapy, there's always a hope to get better or do something better, or will we have a solution? The best way I can say this is hopefully we can take up a way of squiggling together, as Winnicott would do, draw a soul together. And I'll make that more specific as I go along. Firstly, I completely agree. I think one of the communications I've become very aware of is this immense amount of anxiety, which I think is very appropriate given what we are going through. It's a deep existential trauma that's evoking immense amount of death anxiety. I'm again surprised, and maybe I shouldn't be. I think it's my romanticism that gets the better of me, that as adults, I see we just get busier. YouTube gets busier, social media gets busier. What to do, meaning how to structure your day, how to make sure that you don't get bored, to make sure that you have your Netflix and go back to normality. As I see the adults doing their best, running around, trying to give structure. And I think this is usually what we do with anxiety. We structuralize it. I'm astounded watching my adolescent children slowing down, observing more, using more humor. I think in a way, I can hear them being more playful with adults of our reaction to this immense amount of anxiety for us to keep everything together. So I sat with my children a little bit and tried to feel out how they're looking at it. And of course, there could be arguments that they don't understand the complexity that what we are facing and the amount of anxiety, and the fact that they could be playful is a sign of their safety. I would agree with that. On another level, as they were talking, I became aware Todd DeVos always talks about abysmal consolation. I could hear them starting to talk to them, to themselves and to their friends, truly being present in a hospitable way of checking in. What are they doing? How is it for them? They didn't give any specific indication of what we should be doing, how we should be doing it. I was astounded by their ability to be attentive to the here and now in a very non-judgmental way. They remained present. And I was again astounded to see how their friends, the people they had conversations with, spontaneously start coming up with their own soul needs, what they think they need to do. And I was reminded of the work of Dr. Eric Craig, that as a design analyst, he spends a lot of time trying to define this thing we call soul. And I think children, adolescents, and many adults, I'm not saying adults don't have it, have a unique ability to not get bogged down by commodification or the possessive self, to use your language, and to allow the self as it is to be lived, meaning to allow a conversation of the soul of every individual and his own situated gathering of lived experience, not how he should be doing it or should not be doing it or what would be better. I think part of our difficulty today, we have calculative logic rather than meditative logic has given us an idea of purity, that if we find the right way, we can keep anxiety at bay. we have forgotten our own capacities as being our own anxiolytics, so to speak, and how listening to each other is an anxiolytic. It is an antidepressant. I've seen.
Well, let me ask you. Let me ask you a question. Let me ask you a question. I'm sorry. Let me just break in. Thank you. So, do you think love has become calculative? Say, romantic love, spouse love, parent-child love. Has love itself lost its ability to listen, and are we primarily operating in a calculative, instrumental way? I'll give you a cheap example. A husband gives his wife flowers on Valentine's Day. He just has his secretary order them. No thought at all. And the flowers show up. They show up without a deepness of meaning, a deepness of feeling. The spouse feels that. There's a coldness. I got the flowers again. That's what I'm getting at when I say instrumental or calculative love. You know, if I contact my spouse a certain number of times per day or per week, is that love that I'm thinking about it in a calculative way? Maybe you could help us understand that a little bit better. What more meditative listening love looks like, not only in psychotherapy but in more important human relationships. What could that be?
Oh, it's such an intuitive thing. I made notes to talk about love, and I thought that's going to be all my examples tend to be too calculative. So it's interesting that you picked that up. I think your intuition is correct. I have found most of our naturalness, even the word empathy. I was having a conversation with a colleague about empathy because it's such a used word at the moment, and we really struggled to get to the original meaning. Empathy is the old Germanic means to feel in, rather than it's something we possess, meaning you're an empathic person if you give your wife flowers, which is not to me empathy. That is calculated behavior observed that we think is empathy. So if I can come back to your question, and these things are, I hope you can suffer this with me, it's very difficult to put into words. I think to allow love, to allow things to come into being, it's the language of becoming. It is not a thing. I can maybe say we can have arrangements that we can hope that some of this to come in. For example, I think gentle presencing and having curiosity I wouldn't use the word it's the way I presence myself through curiosity, a gentle attentiveness, that I hope the dialogue can relax myself and other person so that elements of love that I think is natural to us can come about, can become. I do not think your example, it's a beautiful example, that is at most our use of memory rather than being with someone where I can naturally feel love come about. Love, empathy, or feeling in, most of these activities are spontaneous gestures that come into the interpersonal domain. It's like, I remember one of my teachers, Professor Baez, he was a strategic therapist. He said, you know, one of the things we can't do, there's a lot of things we can do, but we can't say to a person, be spontaneous. And I think empathy.
Could you spell that person's last name so that our listeners would be able to write that down?
It's B-E-Y-E-R-S, Bayex.
Thank you.
He was
Thank
trained,
you so much.
At the Palo Alto School, Nordone and Václavík. And they had very interesting ways of trying to get people out of binds. And I think if I read Winnicott, if I think of my own analysis, at times gifted theologians, poets like David White, they have a way of speaking that welcomes your attention. It brings you out, but it brings you out in a way that you are allowed to bring whatever intensity or affect or emotion, however we classify these things. That is important, we classify it. I'm not against classification. Allows the person to bring their uniqueness. And that uniqueness will love in a specific way. It will express and work itself in such a way that you feel this person. I remember my analyst once saying to me, "I feel you." And it was a deeply felt moment between myself and my analyst. At times, it's not even a word. My one analyst, she would usually now and then say, just verbalize, "Ah." But I felt held and something transmitted between myself and a person. I think the complexity you bring in here, which is even more difficult, what I'm saying here, is how in groups, how in being with more than one person, given our anxiety, can we remain sensitive to interception, to reverberation, to resonance and reflection, rather than our current reactivity. We are a deeply reactive society if purity or answers or safety is threatened. That's the gift of the calculative, but it was also its shadow side. It took away an ability to remain meditatively aware with ourselves without deep anxiety. Something that you mentioned, the texture of your question reminded me of the difficulty even in psychotherapy. If we start to let go of structures, it's a deeply anxiety-producing moment. Separation and differentiation and taking on one's own creativity is a deeply freeing event, and it's a terrifying event simultaneously to be different, to bring up difference, to bring up what should not be heard or said, frightens us. Dissent is usually to a minimum. I think the first time I heard that language was through people like James Masterson, where when he worked with separation-sensitive individuals, where their very act, I could see it, but I couldn't hear it, and he helped me with analytic ears. Every time this person tries to individuate, to become a person in their own right, there's an immense amount of anxiety and guilt, survivor guilt even at times, that they're taking up their own struggle. I think this happens individually. I think this happens collectively. To go back to your question, how can we do it? I think through gentle presencing, reminding ourselves of abysmal consolation, to meet in a hospitable way the work of Derrida, that we should always welcome the foreigner, the other, with hospitality and with minimum amount of violence is an art and something we struggle with. It's a deep struggle. I don't think it won't necessarily go away. I see times when it's a bit easier for us, and then we have trauma, collective trauma, that we're having now again, where those capacities of ourselves get put under immense amount of pressure. And I think binary thinking strengthens, meaning you're either with us or against us, you're either in or you're out. And then even if we listen to ourselves, if I listen to my own reactions to many of my own fears and frustrations, I first have to struggle with that before I meet another with a gentleness that can allow something to come about, which is not easy at all. But it's possible. It's always possible because it's part of us. The transcendental function, the epistemophilic drive, the true self, all these languages have been accomplishments of our forefathers in analysis and philosophy and theology and in science, of course, that help us push ourselves forward. I am, like you, very concerned that calculative logic has won out too much, that unruly, the unconscious, the unnameable, has become a second-class citizen, even in our own science. But if, again, if I go day to day, if I listen to children and my own children and how children take up, sometimes in a very creative, rebellious way, structures, I remain hopeful that we can do something about it.
Do you think that there is, there's a number of questions here, but do you think that when we engage in calculative thinking or instrumental thinking, that seating at the very bottom of it is not just anxiety, but a suffering, a very complex suffering of being a human being, just a very deep awareness. It's something that I would call pre-ontological, pre-anxious, an acute awareness of the vulnerability of even being in existence, and that that we're all affected by that in some way. Even the greatest professionals or helping professionals still have their own suffering and their own absolute, I'm going to go as far as to say terror, ontological terror, and that there is a comportment in our society, obviously role-dependent, but a comportment that has stifled spontaneous mood states or spontaneous mood flow. And when you were talking about one of your analysts and an experience that you had, I'm sure, more than once, there is a a releasement of some sort in that, I would call it the love event or an eventual mood structure in psychotherapy that is an event, and it does come, I think it's situated below the level of identity, roles, the active-passive distinction, the subject-object distinction, and there's just a being together with in a modal structure, sharing suffering, but also sharing joy. And it seems to me that there is that can only happen when there's a release of some kind, a releasement, an allowing. I think the German is what is Zulassen,
yeah.
Allowing. There's an allowance of something that comes between married people and psychotherapist, client, doctor, patient, friends, colleagues, and you can feel it. There's a There's a really strong feeling attached. So how can we articulate what it is we're releasing in order to presence ourselves in that mood with the other? And that other could be a human being, it could be an animal, it could be water. What are we releasing? What are we giving up? And how are we able to do that and risk this ontological terror? Maybe you could say a couple words about that. I think our listeners would really like that.
Well, Kevin, firstly, I was deeply touched by the way you put it. I felt back there. Just the way you said it. The way you said it and the way you articulated it, it put me back there again, which I'm deeply appreciative of. And I think, especially when you said the difficulty of it, the beauty of it, the joy of it, and the terror of it, it being allowed and released, captures, I think, many of the intuitions I'm trying to bring across. It also reminds me, I'll just for a moment go between two people, Bertrand Russell and then Jaspers. I want to read something that I think shows the difference here. Bertrand Russell, when he wrote the book, A History of Western Philosophy, that actually after it he mentions the suffering he went through mentally writing the book, but he uses words like analytical empirism will achieve definitive answers, that it has an advantage in comparison with the philosophy of system builders, of being able to tackle problems one at a time, that he has no doubt, insofar as philosophical knowledge is possible, is by such methods that it must be sought. I also have no doubt by these methods, many ancient problems are completely soluble. This is Bertrand Russell, the scientist. Then in the early 1900s, he had the following experience. Suddenly, the ground seemed to give way beneath me, and I found myself in quite another region. Within 5 minutes, I went through some sort of reflection as the following. The loneliness of the human soul is unendurable. Nothing can penetrate it except the highest intensity of the sort of love that religious teachers have preached. Whatever does not spring from this motive is harmful, or at best useless, and that in human relations what should penetrate to the core of loneliness in each person can speak to that. At the end of those 5 minutes, I've become a completely different person. For a time, a sort of mystical illumination possessed me. I found myself filled with semi-mystical feelings about beauty and with an intense interest in children, and with a desire almost as profound as that of the Buddha to find some philosophy which should make human life endurable. A strange excitement possessed me, containing intense pain, but also some element of wisdom. The mystical insight, which I then imagined myself to possess, has largely faded, and the habit of analysis has reasserted itself. In something of what I saw in that moment has remained with me always. And when you talked about loneliness, I thought of Jaspers and what you talked about, that region of releasement. Jaspers said, the community of masses of human beings has produced an order in regulated channels which connect individuals in a technically functioning organization, but not inwardly from the historicity of their souls. The emptiness caused by the dissatisfaction with mere achievement and the helplessness that results when the channels of relations break down have brought forth a loneliness of soul such as never existed before, a loneliness that hides itself, that seeks relief in vain in the erotic or the irrational, until it leads eventually to a deep comprehension of the importance of establishment communication between man and man, or in your work, man and nature, because his true nature is nature. So to come back to your question, I think the kind of listening that I felt from you is the kind of listening where something of someone else's loneliness can be taken up and listened to and given back and connected with his immediate narration. I really think, paradoxically, that's more than good enough. There's no need for moreness than for this moment that will fade. We'll look for it again. But we know, I know, I can talk to you. There are analysts and people I've grown very, I can even use the word a deep love for them, because I can know when I recede, when my calculative is reasserted, I can be reminded that this is actually just a product of my loneliness, and try to get back into what Todd DeBose will call our natural inherent Gethsemane experience, that we feel forsaken and alone, and it's difficult, but there are always ears around if we choose to talk and if we are listened to. I think something natural starts to build again. An example, there's also paralleling with the coronavirus, and this example I give does not do justice to the amount of suffering or the losses people are experiencing. I'm just trying to accentuate a possibility that since people have isolated themselves, people sent me photos, even from South Africa, how animals are coming back. That where man was, calculative man was, nature returns. I take that as a deep analogy. If we can receive calculative man, natural, autochthonous, or in your writing, native man, naturally starts coming forward. If we can bracket, as phenomenologists will call it, if we can just hold off our calculative gifts, so to speak, our scientism, which is always in the background reasserting itself, something naturally evolves. I think that's the aim of analytic free association or silence. Not silence as a technique to make someone uncomfortable, but the silence where we watch something start to grow, or we give something silence because we're taking up too much atmospheric oxygen so that something can start to breathe. That we keep words back so words can be found. Things naturally start to move. We have forgotten our naturalness. And naturalness is like spontaneity or Winnicott's creative play. It's spontaneity. We can't force it. It should be allowed. So your thoughts about releasement and allowing whilst remembering the difficulties with it is not a kind of resistance as a difficulty, but beyond resistance is resistance to the real. There's ontological terror. There's the abyss that we need to be kindly present for. I'm thinking of a beautiful quote that Professor DeBose gave me years ago of Caputo, when he talked about against ethics. He said the following: therapists are people who have professed an allegiance to those who have suffered lives of enormous and sometimes unbearable pain. It is not a question of finding an answer to the night of truth, but of sitting up with one another through the night, of dividing the abyss in half in a companion that is its own meaning, It is not a question of introducing a solution from without or from above. Life is healed only by life. The wounds of life can be administered to only by more life. Life pressed against life. Life in life, hand in hand. Siblings of the same dark night. Faith is above all the hermeneia that someone looks back at us from the abyss, that the spell of anonymity is broken by a someone who stands with us, who also suffers. So again, I think it comes back to your idea, and this is, the phenomenal work of Michael Eigen. He suffers with, he suffers through. He's always present in a way. Life then returns to us in a very deep, transformative, autochthonous way.
Let me respond, if I may. There's a lot that you just said. I'd like to mention the distinction between being and having. The distinction between conscious and unconscious. And then to make some comments about violence and complacence. So it's always been my thought that the self really is just an awareness that's empty. There's really nothing in there. It's a process. And we've been taught in this culture to fill it up, to go to the gas station and fill up the self. And we do this. We're pushed to do it. Even those who sit with suffering, therapists, scientists, philosophers, writers, thinkers, helpers of all kinds, doctors, are also pushed to choose identities and choose things to have, to possess things, to have, to fill up that self, and even to fill up that self with ideas, and to fill up the self with ideas so much so that they become noise. Sometimes there are so many ideas in a dialogue or a class or a seminar or a book that it becomes noise. And that's not to say that the ideas are inherently non-valuable, but that they create an impediment to listen. That's one thing. The second, and I'm going to tie all these together. The second thing is instrumental reasoning. Doesn't it try to squeeze out the sayings of the unconscious? Doesn't it really do that? Calculative thinking. Hey, I'm too busy to worry about the unconscious. I've got my task at hand. I'm going to go. And we're produced as subject to be conscious, forced into it. And I just want to say, we are just about out of time, and we have about another minute. And so the question I want to leave you with is, how do we know that we're not violent in ourselves? And how does that unconscious violence come from having? And how does it prevent us from deep listening? Maybe a couple of comments, and then I'm going to have to close our interview, and we could come back to it in a few weeks if you'd like.
Oh, that's again a powerful question. I'm married to Heidegger in a sense. I think all analysis is a form of violence, and I think there is something like a creative violence. And there's a very destructive violence. And I know it's too difficult to get into now. I think what I've tried to cultivate, and my mentors have helped me tremendously, Kevin, yeah, is that I completely agree. I think that incessant chattering is starting to be an incessant internal chattering that's making it very difficult for people to hear their natural way of doing things. What I've tried to do is to make myself aware. At times it's the best I can do in a gentle way, that I'm modeling or thinking or being calculative, and try to give myself a bit of freedom to bracket it and to put it to one side, and to literally like take a fresh breath and to see what the other is helping me understand or listen to. Many times I get in my own way, too many times. And fortunately, Robert Lance and others have taught me to listen closely. Our people in dialogue with us tell us when we are in their way. And Lance has helped me listen to the people who tell you, hold on, or no, or that's not quite right. So I've not only had to learn to trust myself, but also the other to help me stay the course with creative listening. It's a dialogue between two people to keep that part alive in ourselves and in others.
Ray, Dr. Dawes, thank you so much. There's much food for thought here, many questions. I think that you've opened up some really good inquiries for meditation and feeling, the thinking for all of our listeners. For me, you have, hopefully for yourself. We have to end our show today, and
thank you,
if you'd like to come back in a few weeks, then we'll continue. But I want to thank you and stay safe, Larray. And
thank you. You too.
We'll be talking to you soon. Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you, Kevin.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. Bye bye. This is Ephes Radio. Signing out and wishing everybody a safe and well day and rest of the week.